Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I am your new host, Hayley Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. This week, we look at what's behind the social uprisings led by youth across Africa. Is it about politics? Is it about the economy? Young people demanding change on the streets and social media. But what does that change really look like? We'll hear from Nigeria's End SARS protesters, some in hiding because they fear retaliation from the government. Also, unfiltered and in her own words, Aya Chebbi's blog helped start a revolution in Tunisia. She was the AU's first ever youth envoy, and now she tells us what she's learned about Africa's young people and what they really want. All that and more coming up. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Throughout Africa, young people are raising their hands in protest. In South Africa, the Fees Must Fall movement was about unaffordable tertiary education. In Senegal, it was about accountability for public officials. In Sudan, the price of bread sparked a revolution. Why are so many young people rising up? In October last year, the End SARS movement saw young Nigerians call for an end to police brutality and corruption. But now some protesters say they are facing a backlash. Our reporter Timothy Obiezu spoke to those who were on the front lines as they confront the aftermath of their street demonstrations.
Haiti, this is Lagos, Nigeria's economy capital, and the city where the End SARS movement took its biggest form. I spoke to some of the leaders of the protest. They say that the impact of Nigeria's systemic police brutality can still be felt here and beyond the city.
Two brothers in Ogbomosho, a neighboring city, are visiting the graveyard where their little brother Jimo Ishak was buried 7 months ago. Jimo, 22, was hit by a bullet they say was fired by the police to disperse protesters last October. He was the last born of the family and their parents' favorite.
You see that issue? There is nothing we can do since God allowed it to happen. Ishak was the closest to me.
Life has been tough here for the family since the incident. Local tradition and Islam forbid parents from visiting or knowing their child's grave. All they have left is this picture of him.
I love this picture so much, and I would like to remake it. There's no time I wake up that I do not think of Ishak.
The family wants clarity on the incident. Local police authorities deny that their bullet killed Ishak and wouldn't comment on this report. However, this mobile phone footage obtained from the family shows officers charging towards protesters from a police station just across the road where Jimo Ishak stood moments before he was shot. The family also alleges that the police had pressured them to discontinue the case, but human rights lawyer Hussein Afolabi is helping them seek justice.
When Jimo's parents, I was trying to make sense of the whole thing, trying to get as much facts as from them as possible and all of that, then we started hearing the police firing gunshots. At that time, it wasn't a protest. At that time, it was angry, sad youths that were protesting the senseless killing of Jimo Ishak.
In October, the world's attention was on Nigeria as protests to end police brutality swept through many cities for 2 weeks. The protests were led by the country's younger citizens who said they were simply tired of being profiled by operatives of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS. The Lekki tollgate in Lagos was strategic during the protests. And after many days of sustained outcries, a major victory was announced.
The Special Anti-Robbery Squad of the Nigerian Police, otherwise known as SARS, is hereby dissolved across all formations.
But protester demands soon expanded to include calls for better governance, fight against corrupt government systems, and more political involvement. More than half of Nigeria's population is under 30. Political experts warned that expanding protest demands could be dangerous and that bad governance can only be addressed on the ballot. But the protesters pressed on. Then, this happened. The night of October 20 will be remembered in Nigeria for long. Amnesty International says at least 12 protesters were killed at the Lekki toll gate when Nigerian forces opened fire. But authorities deny the killing and say officers fired blanks into the air. However, the shooting triggered global criticisms. Back home, angry protesters burned the city. And then, the once busy streets went from this to this. President Muhammadu Buhari addressed the nation, called for calm, and promised to fulfill protester demands. Critics, however, say many months later, not much has been done. Instead, protesters say they have been targeted and punished, most of them through restrictions on their bank accounts. Due to the crackdown, some have gone into hiding, fled the country, or just wouldn't talk about this topic anymore. But some are brave enough to speak.
Police brutality may have sparked the protest, but bad governance is the fundamental reason why young Nigerians actually went out on the street.
22-year-old Rino Odwala was a popular face during the protests. But experts say she and other protest leaders failed to provide a negotiating front with authorities.
In some of these social and political conflicts, at critical moments, you need to be able to negotiate outcomes. What the government got right was to say, yes, these are reasonable demands, and every reasonable government should implement them.
Many victims are waiting for a verdict from various panels of inquiry set up by the government. But Amnesty International doubts the credibility of the process.
Despite the constitution of judicial panels of inquiries across the nation, there remains a thick mist of fear about the possibility of this process delivering justice.
Amnesty International has profiled 82 cases of abuse by SARS since 2017. They say there's more, and the road to justice is bumpy. Until then, leaders of the movement say a race has just begun, one that could redefine Nigeria's future.
Haiti and SARS movement leaders say there is a message here for the rest of Africa that young people must stand up to persistent government failures and political orders that they believe do not represent their interests. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Timothy Obiezu in Lagos, Nigeria for us with that in-depth report. Timothy, thank you. Now, NSARS is just one of dozens of youth-led movements across Africa. How effective are these uprisings and what have they actually accomplished? I put those questions to Kamisa Kamara. She's the former Foreign Affairs Minister of Mali and an expert for the Sahel with the United States Institute of Peace. She wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post recently about this issue. Also, Dima Mahmoud is a political analyst and expert in Sudanese foreign policy. She brings us some unique insight from the revolution in Sudan. I spoke to the two of them earlier. Kamisa and Dima, I want to thank you so much for your time. Kamisa, I'm going to put the first question to you first. What is behind these social uprisings? Is this about politics? Is it about economic issues? All of that, more than that? What are the trends that you're seeing?
Thank you, Haiti. I think what we've seen, especially in West Africa, where I would say over the past 10 years, we've seen a lot of youth uprising on social media, on TV. They've made headlines. I think they're about politics, they're about economics, they're about job creation, they're about human rights, they're about a lot of issues. But I think the main takeaway here is that we are dealing with at least 50% of West African population being under the age of 20. And so we're seeing these young people telling the older ones who are basically the rulers that they are not going to let them do things the way they've been doing over the past 20, 30, 50 years, and that they want to be in charge of their own future. And so the uprisings that we're seeing are about many issues, but I think the common theme here, the common denominator, is these youth and young folks saying, we are going to take charge of our future and we are going to set the agenda for it.
And Dima, what's your take?
Absolutely. In many ways, yes. There is, I would add a deeper or something that I have been recognizing more is the awakening element. We have heard time and time again, this being a revolution of consciousness. So it's transcending all the labels and disciplines and all the different hamster wheels, politics or our misleaders on the continent seem intent on placing us in. And I think it also goes beyond the youth, going beyond just the elders as in the rulers, but also within society, saying things within society itself must change. It's no longer just about the face of a regime. It's no longer about a name or a particular party. The entire system needs to come down, and we're seeing this transcend borders. We're seeing an uprising in Sudan, the youth in Sudan, but at the heart of a revolution in Algeria, we're seeing Sudanese flags come up. We're seeing our Kenyan brothers and sisters outside the Supreme Court being tear gassed because they are demanding accountability from their government to hold another government accountable because their brothers and sisters are on the street demanding this justice. So there's also this sense of coming togetherness as a continent, and more so even as just youth of African ancestry, because this extends to the diaspora, to the larger global Black Lives Movement. And we're seeing that on many fronts, as I'm hoping to get deeper into with this conversation. And thank you, Haiti.
And speaking of this coming together, I think we've seen some parallels between these movements on the continent, just the vast and fast mobilization, the online activism, and I think just the mere imagery of young people coming out and putting their bodies on the streets. But we've also seen some differences in that some seem to be centered around a figurehead, a personality. Look at Bobby Wine in Uganda, Ousmane Sonko in Senegal. But then others seem to be centered around a particular cause. Does a movement need a personality or a figurehead to be successful long term, Khamisa?
Well, I'm curious to hear what Dima will say about the question, but I almost feel like there needs to be not necessarily a figurehead, but almost a common enemy, whether it is a cause, whether it is a person leading the charge. I don't think that determines the success of the uprisings. And so these youth uprisings are not new. They're new in terms of exposure to the world and to other youth in the region. And so that's what's new. But coming back to your question about figureheads, I do not believe that these movements necessarily need a figurehead, even though one does come out, over time. You have either a leader of the group that emerges as one that will be the catalyst for all the efforts, or this a common cause. So at the end of the day, there will be something leading these revolutions and these uprisings, and they don't necessarily determine the successes of those revolutions.
And Dima, in Sudan, it started out as a cause around the price of bread. Do you think a personality or central figurehead or leader is necessary or not?
Absolutely not. No. So when I said earlier it is an awakening, it is literally a stepping into our power, which means it is the recognition that we are all leaders. It means the recognition that we have been conditioned to confuse politics and power. So it was not a leaderless revolution. We were all leaders and we were all on the streets or in offices or in clinics or in outside embassies. The concept of leading came from drawing strength from one another. The issues really started boiling up when a leadership figure began emerging. In fact, I would argue that having a leader figure or a specific go-to is one of the quickest ways to break a revolution or to break that movement today, because it is the quickest way to trigger the divide and conquer practice, which our misleaders are quite notorious at anyway. So I wouldn't say it is necessary for the success of a revolution. I would say the main thing necessary to the success of the revolution is keeping the demands front and center, understanding that we cannot compartmentalize what we have gone out for. So if we're going out, we're going out and we're getting everything we demanded. And there's no, we've passed the point of breadcrumbs. We've passed the point of, well, it's a process. Well, let's wait and see and do this, because that's how things start slipping. And this is exactly what we are witnessing now in Sudan. There's thought, there's words, there's action. How we think about something dictates how we talk about it, and how we talk about it dictates what we do about it or what we do towards it. How we think about politics dictates what we say and how we talk about politics, and how we talk about politics dictates how we engage with politics. And the same thing with power. What's happening now is an understanding that just because there is a leader in a revolution or someone is leading a revolution does not necessarily mean that this will stay consistent, and that there needs to be an immediate and transparent and solid track of accountability. Otherwise, we're looking at another 30 years of lying, like in the case of Eritrea, or we don't need to go so far. There's DRC, and right now, again, as I said, what is currently happening in Sudan. There is this shift, and I think this shift comes from, for the longest time, youth hearing this utter disgust towards politics. All we heard about politics is that politics is dirty. Politics is dirty and politics is corruption. And you see people dying and it's blamed on politics. Who in their right minds wants to engage with that? No. What's happening now, or at least with I would say in the case of Sudan, and I'm pretty sure I can say also from conversations with comrades, whether in Congo or Nigeria or southern Cameroon, when you reach that point of being so fed up, you're no longer thinking. So you're no longer thinking about how dirty politics is. You just need it to end.
Kamisa, you wanted to add something.
What she just said about the youth mixing or thinking that politics and power are the same really rang a bell for me, because I did work in government and was very confused about why, as government officials, we were so loathed by these young folks. I would observe what was happening in the news, but there is this almost this disgust towards politics, politicians, and so everything that politicians do or anything that a government official does is being either criticized or being met with a lot of doubt or suspicion. And so it jeopardizes any work that any government official will do. And I think that there is a lot of cleaning up to do. There has to be a recast of how we project politics on the continent, how politicians do act, because something is just not adding up. Something is wrong there, and something needs to be repaired.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about online activism and the power of social media to really rally people to the point where we have seen entire regimes fall. I read recently that hashtags seem to have succeeded where international arrest warrants have fallen short. How powerful is social media? Is it as powerful as we think? And does it have its limitations?
Is it as powerful as we think it is? Yes. possibly even more. But we also have to be mindful that there is a digital divide. And that is not necessarily to use that as a limitation, but it is for us to start working around what that looks like. We're already seeing people who have access to transport, who will go to places without the internet or without phones or without this access to get this footage and put it out there, or get the news and put it out there, or use phone calls. There are ways that it's being maneuvered or outmaneuvered. And to me, that's the exciting part. And I would wager that it's really more the excitement than it is impatience with this generation. It is understanding that we can come out here and we can sit here and not move, and we may not get what we want, and we may lose a lot, but you're not coming out the way you want either. And I think from there, it's more determination, it's more anticipation than it is impatience, I would say. And I think that's one of the other things that's being thrown at the youth today, is that, oh, this impatience is going to waste this revolution. This impatience is going to waste everything you've reached so far. No. It's going back into a slumber of accepting compartmentalized justice is what's going to get us back to where we were. We must keep pressing, and full force.
Camisa.
Social media has been this huge disruptor of politics on the African continent. We were talking about the perception of politics being dirty, of politicians being not so great people. And I almost feel like we have entered an era where politicians or people who are in power cannot do what they want anymore. They are being scrutinized by everybody that has access to a minimum of information. I'm not saying that it's always positive. It is very powerful, as Dima said. I totally agree with her. And I also agree with the fact that we might not have exploited social media as much as we should. But the reason why I'm saying that social media has been a disrupting factor in politics is that we've seen on the continent politicians doing things differently because of their reputation on social media, or because of how they're perceived on social media. Every single step they do is going to be scrutinized on social media. And that's why you're seeing an increasing number of people in power having a social media platform, wanting to be very transparent about everything they say, explain things that they do one step at a time, because they do understand that being social media savvy will either make or break their positions. And so I think it's important to look at it this way. And, you cannot help but think about what social media, or maybe what the next big thing is going to be within the next 10 years. I don't think that 15 years ago, we would have imagined that we would have such instant reactions to anything that is happening in one country or the other. And so what I foresee is that it's going to be more and more difficult for any person who's not coming into politics or coming into a position of power with, quote unquote, a clean heart and an honest mission to do the thing that they want to do. Things have changed radically, and we have to understand it as it is.
This is exactly the dynamic I mean about the difference and the clear distinction between politics and power. And social media is one of the tools that helped pull that veil to show that distinction. That no, just because you're in politics doesn't mean you have all the power, or that you can get away with everything, because people still have the power to get this information and hold it against you. At least that's just one way of them.
Now, given what we've discussed so far, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being a complete disaster, 10 being very successful, how would you rate the effectiveness of the social movements, Khamisa, that we have seen on the continent in the last 5 to 6 years?
It's hard to say, but as, you know, someone who's, I've worked with civil society organizations, I've funded them, especially in Western Central Africa. And then I stepped into government. And I can tell you that, you know, the last thing you want to see as a government official is youth on the streets. You do not want to see that. So just because of that, I'm going to say that it's a 10 out of 10.
I would agree. There's definitely a lot more to be done, but I think we're 10 and counting. By comparison, it's 10 and counting, but there's definitely room for more. And I think that more part has to do more internally, and again, has to do more with us holding ourselves accountable before even having the audacity to hold the governments accountable. And that's something that that's a bit of a challenge still with the youth, because there's still a little bit of that entitlement, naturally.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture politics and humility going together. Yeah, that's my struggle. And we'll bring you more from that discussion just after the break. Also, youth activist Aya Chebi will talk about what she's learned about the hopes of young Africans. All of that coming up. Stay with us. We're back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. We're talking about why so many young Africans are rising up and the impact of their protests on political and social change on the continent. Here's more now from my discussion with analysts Dima Mahmoud and Khamisa Kamara. Dima, Khamisa, if you could single out a particular social movement that you think really got it right in terms of just laser focus and accomplishing what they had set out to do, what comes to mind for you?
You know, the first movement that came to mind was the Yanamar movement in Senegal. I think it was 2012. Yanamar in English, we've had enough. It was a spontaneous youth movement put together because of the fact that Abdoulaye Wade, who was president at the time in Senegal, was seeking a third term. And so they wanted to make sure that the Constitutional Court does not allow President Abdoulaye Wade to seek a third term. The Constitutional Court did allow him to do that, but then they did change their strategy immediately, and the strategy was to make sure that the youth registers to vote and votes that president out of office. And they succeeded in doing that. And that was, I think, one of the most successful youth movements of, you know, our contemporary age in West Africa. And then right after that, in 2014, you had the Ballet Citoyen in Burkina Faso, in English, Citizens Broom, which made sure that President Blaise Compaoré, who was seeking, I don't know, fifth term or sixth term, he had been in power for 27 years, that he leaves office. And basically, they made sure that he leaves the country, and they, you know, put back a democratically elected president. These are, you know, extreme cases, and there are many other movements that that you can look at in either West Africa or Central Africa. But these are the two that really come to mind as spontaneous movements that were not necessarily actually using social media as much as we are today, but the power of mobilization that these youth groups had at the time was so immense that it was quite scary to watch, but in a positive manner. They were able to do so much in so little time that, you know, they have to be recognized as very courageous and very organized, very audacious, and they were able to succeed whatever they came together to do.
I would hesitantly, carefully, cautiously reference Tunisia as part of the Arab tsunami that took over North Africa, in that while there are still a lot of complaints and a lot of issues within the general trajectory, there are certain demands and definite milestones that have been reached since the revolution that cannot be dismissed and cannot just be put to the side. More to that, I cannot share the same optimism or affirmation as Khamisa just yet.
Khamisa, you spoke earlier about the Yanomar movement's strategy to effect change at the ballot box. Is that a strategy that young people are really sticking to? Because if I look at the Nigerian election in 2019, lowest voter turnout since that country returned to democracy in 1999, and also lowest voter turnout on the continent. Also in South Africa, same year, 2019, in that election, lowest youth voter turnout in the country's democratic history. Youth there saying they get what they want when they protest and not when they come out to vote. Do you think that is a general perception? And why young people show up in greater numbers at protests than they do at the polls?
People get what they want when they protest because it's not about politics. They don't trust the political system to go vote. They don't trust the political leaders. They don't trust the political representation. They don't trust engaging with that system that has been deliberately and intently oppressing them, bleeding them dry, and pushing them into broken boats into water to join our ancestors who were forced out of the continent. Our youth are willingly doing that. So they have nothing to hope for, to trust in. The only option is to protest. The only option is to reclaim power by dismantling politics, by dismantling the current political system. One of the things that's always thrown back at the protesters is the void boogie, the vacuum, the power vacuum boogie. It's like, oh, but, you know, if we leave now, then everything will disintegrate. No, but there was a fully functioning entity at the sit-in outside the army headquarters in Sudan. Sudanese people were chartering planes and just coming in as volunteers, carrying everything they can to support the people. What stopped this process, what stopped the mechanism of this, the direction that this is going, all of these things get divided as soon as the void vacuum is thrown out. But we're organizing already. We don't lack the knowledge. We don't lack the expertise. And social media, one of the most amazing thing that social media has done is really create that a space of home between mainland and diaspora. And there is that need for engagement. There is that interest for engagement. It's just being halted and stopped by what we have been conditioned to believe as part and parcel of the psychological warfare waged against us as people of African ancestry in general and youth, African youth today, specifically on the continent. We have been conditioned to believe that we are powerless, that we are lacking, that we will not amount to anything, and that if we do, we need to get the seal of approval from outside, from the West.
I want to move now to my final question. Now, across the continent, we've had a fascinating lineup of charismatic leaders and freedom fighters who really fired people up in the 50s and the 60s. In many cases, those resistance leaders and freedom fighters, those heroes went on to become the president of the country. And in some cases, with very disappointing results. I am from Southern Africa. We have seen that for sure. Here's the universal question. Should those who lead uprisings necessarily be the ones who end up leading the country? Khamisa.
So, Heidi, I think it's a question that we're probably all faced in all of our countries. And it's always been a very difficult discussion to have, because those who, you know, fought for either democracy or for the return to constitutional order for, you know, countries that have had coups or whatever, are not necessarily the best equipped to lead the country. From a purely technical point of view, it's difficult, because those who fought to liberate, quote unquote, the country will feel entitled that, well, if we liberated the country, then we should be in charge. But being in charge doesn't necessarily, liberating the country didn't necessarily give you the right to lead. And these are very difficult discussions to have. I don't know if I'm giving you the answer to your question, but I've struggled with that idea. And I would not name any countries, but looking at West Africa, looking at Central Africa, these questions have... one doesn't necessarily lead to the other. And of course, you're going to make some people very unhappy because of that. And if we want to, you know, get out of this pattern that we've seen over the years, I think we need to have a clear scope of work as to what the qualifications of the new leaders are going to be. And it cannot just be the people who liberated the country. And it's really... It's a difficult discussion to have. I don't know, Dima, what you can add to that, but I was trying to be very cautious with my answer, as you noticed.
I can add Eritrea to that mix. I can add DRC with absolutely no shame, and I add Sudan to that hat as well. There's plenty more. Your face said it all, Kamisa. When the question was asked, it was just this moment of reckoning where you say, now we're talking. Now we're really talking. Because I think this goes back to some, Heidi, what you were saying earlier in the conversation about having a leader versus leaderless revolution. And you're making the comparison to the independence revolutions, or the revolutions that led to independence, let's say. Those leaders were not the ones actually leading the countries, you will notice. As soon as they got in power, or if they got in power, they were immediately eliminated, and they were replaced by people who will maintain the status quo to assure the colonizers that you will continue to have access to this land and to what we have to offer. We just need to have some form of agreement of what the theatrics will be. And I think this is at the heart of what we're facing right now. And I think this is also why we're seeing more movements without that leader, without that one leader. You will see a movement led by a principle, by a value, by a cause, but not a person.
If I may add, Dima,
please.
That's a very important question. I think what we're seeing here is the conflict between legality and legitimacy. Mm. Fighting for a cause, that gives you a lot of legitimacy, but what will give you the legality to lead is not the same. And I think that there has to be a right balance between the two. And as Dima, you were talking earlier about the young folks leading those revolutions, I wanted to say that again, as having worked in government, I am not a politician. I am a technician who was brought into government for technical skills. And so I wanted to make that clear. And what I've always struggled with is the gap between the expectations of what a government can do, which is very much different from what a government can do in reality because of lack of resources, because of lack of human resources. And I have to say, we might have a lot of talented youth, but not anybody and everybody can be in government. And we have to say it. You might be skilled at a certain, you might have a certain set of skills, but that doesn't mean that you are fit to be in government. And what we are seeing, unfortunately, is that because you have youth on social media communicating directly with government officials, some of them do feel that they can be in a position of power and they can be in government. And I'm sorry, but I have to say, who do you think you are sometimes? You know, you have to be patient. You have to put in the time. It's not because you can speak with me on social media and insult me that you can be in my shoes. And you have to be humble too. And social media, unfortunately, does not allow for that humility to happen. I just want to add that.
It doesn't allow for the reality check. You know, it doesn't allow the check it's concerned with is the blue one that's after the name for you to be verified as such. Currently, there is a bit of a rut in the exhaustion, in the sheer exhaustion of balancing the legitimacy and the legality that Kamisa was talking about, because yes, having the legitimacy for the cause, but also getting the recognition internationally of what has happened, but then to find yourself back in the same cycle and in the same circle, then it's no longer about the legality. The question becomes, how legitimate is the system setting up the laws and setting up the rules to create who is a leader and who is legal to be a leader? And I am absolutely with you in that not everyone is fit to lead. I personally don't believe that the current prime minister of Sudan is fit for that position. As an economist, as a minister of fine, sure. As a minister of okay. As a prime minister, the capacity to lead this country out of what it has been in? No. And this isn't just something for the youth to be humbled with and to reckon with. This is, again, it goes back to the accountability of self, how we hold ourselves accountable to be able to hold the government accountable. Something I always say to my friends, to young people and to older people who keep complaining about the situation is that, what have you been doing for it? You go, you stand in line, but you'll take some money out and you'll bribe someone to go ahead in the street. You're part of this problem. You are just as complacent. You have no right to complain. And it moves forward. I do see a more deliberate attempt at youth holding each other accountable, at reminding each other of the lessons that they have personally experienced. Because for the longest time now, our concept and our contact with revolution and liberation has been through books, through lines, through what our elders would tell us. But now there is a field experience. Even if you weren't the person in the revolution, as you said, there are different ways to contribute. You had technical skills to contribute to the government. The same way with activism, not everyone's going to be out on the not everyone's going to be out on the street protesting. People protest by art, people protest. And it is this openness to engaging politics in different disciplines and in its different faces and phases that to me is encouraging and gives me plenty of hope. Also doesn't let me sleep, but I am more hopeful than anything else and more certain that our revolution definitely continues, because this is a revolution of consciousness.
Dima Mahmoud, Kamisa Kamara, what a great conversation. But I have to leave it there. I appreciate your insight so much, and I do thank you for your time. Now, we also put a question to you on social media. Do you think the youth-led street and online protests we've seen have been effective in bringing about social and political change? I'm going to read some of the comments that you've shared with us. Here's what Sabinus Chiravira in Ghana says. Somehow not a single uprising in Africa has had its president make drastic changes in policy. In Africa, you can be shot or kidnapped by the state, tear gassed, and beaten to a pulp by the government for standing up. In Ghana, fix the country is one demonstration your reporters should watch out for. Matthew Julius in Uganda says there could be change brought about by Africa's youth, but they will not succeed in leading the country on the right path. Which African countries have been successful after an uprising? Look at Libya, Zimbabwe, Sudan, to mention just a few. And then Businge Emmanuel, also in Uganda, says, to a greater extent, the youth-led uprisings have done more harm than good. Look at Sudan. The country continues to struggle to get back on track. The North African countries are worse off today than before the Arab Spring. As Africans, we need to revisit the efficacy of regime change through uprisings. The Libyans must be wondering what befell them. I think the current situation makes the late Muammar Gaddafi a saint of sorts to some Libyans. And we do thank you for always sharing your comments with us. Please continue to connect with us on social media. We always love to hear from you. It was her political blog that helped start a revolution in Tunisia more than 10 years ago. Aya Chebbi's online activism helped propel her to global fame. As the African Union's first ever special youth envoy, she traveled around the continent, listening and speaking to young Africans. On the international stage, she advocated for Africa's youth agenda to more than 160 global leaders. Well, I caught up with Chebbi recently and asked her what she's learned about young Africans and what this generation really wants.
Being in Africa now is so exciting for me because all I see is progress, progress.
Many of the demands of youth is around the delivery of services.
That's why you need to have your voice heard at the African Union level.
We are all from all generations, an integral part of change and transformation.
I always say we're the coolest and the better educated generation and the most innovative generation. And I think what is unique about us as African youth, because we reach a point in history right now, like the millennials, we are the youngest in history and in the world. We're 65% under 30 as African youth and our population in Africa. So we have this demographic power that didn't exist before. So when young people take to the street when no one listens, it's really power. It's in masses. Even before joining the African Union, I traveled across 30 African countries at least, just, you know, living with my comrades and to see that we have the same issues. We are products of the same regimes, the same systems, the same structures. And that gives us also the power when we come together, we can have those solutions to apply to many of our countries. So I think the Pan-African space for my generation right now is very unique compared to like the 60s and 50s, because at the time they wanted to create nation states. For them, the achievement was independence. But for us, we want a borderless continent. We want e-governance. We want, you know, to live on the internet, to innovate. We want e-commerce. We want to trade. We want different things, but it's very unique to our generation. Even though we are oppressed, you know, like the internet shutdown is really oppressing a lot of young people to innovate online. The police brutality when young people go out to the streets is oppressing young people from expressing themselves. A lot of young people today live on a daily basis feeling that I can die of COVID-19 or I can die of hunger or I can die on the Mediterranean. It's the same for me. I do not enjoy as a young person my basic human right. And that could be from living in poverty, to not being able to express yourself, to your government not believing in you, not investing in you, to your startup dying, you know, after putting all your dreams on it after 1 year because no one supports you, to you as a young woman, you know, finding yourself double crime because you're young and you're female, to people with disability, to finding yourself in a refugee camp. So all these are forms of marginalization and layers of marginalization. But I think the bottom line of it is the perception of injustice, that it's not fair that we have the youngest continent in the world and we're run by old men. It's just not fair. So that perception that it's not fair that 70% of Africa is offline while the rest of the world is enjoying their access to internet. It's not fair that we don't contribute to climate change and we're the most impacted for it. So those perception of injustice, for me, is what makes young people feel marginalized, and it makes them feel, okay, then I belong to a violent group, or I belong to an extremist group, or I can find an alternative space of belonging because my government, my state, my community doesn't value me, basically. It goes down to, am I valued as a young person? No. We still live in a continent that doesn't care about its youthful population, even though in speeches and in discourses and it's all about demographic dividend. But concretely, you know, there is no value and justice in what this generation really deserves. I was fascinated how in the 50s and 60s they could mobilize across borders. And in 1 year, in 1960, 10 countries got independence, and they had no Facebook, no WhatsApp, no any tools to do that. And I'm like, this is African solidarity. This is being, feeling that your liberation is my liberation. That if Tunisia doesn't get independence, I'm not liberated in Ghana. That if Zimbabwe doesn't get independent, I'm not liberated in Tanzania. They were talking about one language. They were talking about one continent. They were talking about fighting imperialism, fighting colonization. Yes, the Pan-Africanism had a different meaning in the 1650s. It had different meaning in the fight against apartheid. It had different meaning for my, you know, mothers and fathers and grandfathers. It has different meaning for us. So it is for my generation to redefine it, and it is for other generations to accept that we have a different vision because we are facing different challenges. We can't come to 21st century, you know, solutions and challenge it with 20th century tools. It cannot. It just will not work. So when I started mobilizing Pan-African in 2011, actually, quite after Tunisia's revolution, and seeing that we inspired Senegal, Yonamar movement, we inspired Ballet Citoyen in Burkina, we inspired the whole continent to rise up, we inspired Fees Must Fall to go on the street. And to me, that was, for me, an opportunity. How can we take that moment and momentum now to build a Pan-African spirit, to build a Pan-African movement? And I'm happy to see the past decade, this is growing. Standing in solidarity with ANSAR, standing with solidarity with Ugandan youth, standing with solidarity with different young people, whether it's in election time, whether when it's social movement going on the streets. It's fascinating. But I think what we need to do now is to organize. Now we have the momentum, we have the spirit, we understand the struggle, we understand we come from one history and we're going to one destiny. But I think organizing now what will take the continent to the next level, because then the leaders will realize that you cannot go away by doing what you do in your country, because other young people in other countries will call you out and will stand up for those young people. So I hope we can reach that level of organizing.
And that was youth activist Aya Chebi speaking to me from Addis Ababa. Now, if you want to know how people feel about the society and the times they live in, look at the writing on the walls. Across the world, graffiti and street art have become an important part of social protest. You're in the United States. 1 year after the demonstrations over the death of George Floyd, the city of Seattle is grappling with a complicated question. What to do with the protest art and graffiti that some see as vandalism and others see as history in the making? VOA's Natasha Mosgovaya has more.
In the heart of Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood, graffiti and murals cover walls and pieces of plywood guarding shop windows. The largest display for mass protests last summer includes the words Black Lives Matter painted on the road. It stretches for the whole block on East Pine Street.
I painted the L, love, legacy, life.
15 local artists collaborated on this, each bringing their unique style to the project.
For myself, I do a self-portrait that's a shark, sunflower, like octopus tentacles. It's more or less like everyone sees my personality is very bright, very fun, but I'm a crazy person. And then, of course, the main attraction is the beautiful black women. I like to depict them kind of as giants or goddesses, because as a black man, they've been a very big, pivotal part of my life.
The mural, painted at the height of summer protests sparked by the death of George Floyd, has been called the symbol of free speech and civil rights. To preserve it, Seattle's Arts and Culture Office joined the artists and the city's Department of Transportation to get the work fully repainted.
Time we did it was more of a street art graffiti kind of thing where we didn't really ask permission, we just took claim. The second time around, it was definitely a mural. We got paid, we're going to make sure this is done right.
For some letters, it took as many as 5 layers of paint to ensure it can withstand street conditions. The process was a moment of collaboration as the city, which was the focus of protesters' frustrations at times, reconfigured the road and added traffic diverters to protect the mural.
So it's supposed to stay for about 5 years, but I'm hoping it stays forever. I'm hoping it becomes a part of Seattle culture, and I'm reminding that we really need to take black lives seriously, not for granted. They're just like, we're just like you.
This mural belongs to the people. This mural belongs to the artists. We're just there to offer our assistance and resources.
The city code requires small business owners to either clean up graffiti on their property or face fines. In the spontaneous outburst of protest art, though, it is not always clear where the line between vandalism and art is.
We do know that, you know, we should at least preserve some of these murals that have been created on businesses and trying to do our best to, you know, to preserve this, because, you know, it's one of those moments in history that you want to capture and preserve to sort of, you know, show what we went through as a culture or as a country.
That plywood belongs to the owner of that business and or building in most cases. And so it's up to them on what, if they want to donate it or they want to keep it themselves. But the main goal is preservation, to tell the story and remember this moment in history.
Not all Seattle residents remember the protests as something to be celebrated. There were acts of violence and destruction by some of the protesters, leading to clashes with police as authorities attempted to regain control over the rioting. A large patch of bulldozed soil in Calenderson Park is all that is left of a self-declared autonomous zone, the CHOP, created by the protesters. Pieces that were made there are now traveling with activists around Seattle.
This is one of the black fists that was from the CHOP art. And then we have about, I want to say close to like 200 pieces of plywood from the boards and barricades that were in the CHOP. I was actually arrested trying to stop the CHOP art from being taken from the CHOP. So I feel very, I'm very passionate about this.
Today, most of the protesters' camp artwork is in a storage facility and is subject to an ownership dispute between the protest veterans. As for the plywood murals, some shop owners plan to display them, return them to the artists, or donate them to local nonprofits and museums. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Seattle.
Remember, you can always find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Do continue to connect with us there. We always love to hear from you. I will see you next week. For now, from me, Heidi Adams, thank you so much for watching. Goodbye.